region. We have two guests with us this hour to talk about the Encyclopedia of Life. Jeff Holmes is digital learning editor for Encyclopedia of Life. Jeff, thank you so much for being with us.
Great to be here. Thanks.
Yeah, it's nice to have you here. And also joining us is Bob Corrigan. And Bob is the product manager and acting director of acting deputy director is the right way to put it, of Encyclopedia of Life. Bob, thank you so much for being with us as well.
Thank you.
Yeah. Well, let's start with what all you've been able to collect. How this has been around since what, 2007 or 2008?
The Encyclopedia of Life went live in 2008, and since the Encyclopedia of Life started, we've been able to develop detailed species pages for just about 400,000 of the 1.9 million identified species of life. And it's a process that, as you can imagine, takes time.
Well, sure.
And certainly one that we need the help of everyone to contribute content and help us identify sources of content.
And how do you find out what the life is? And how do you discover life that is new?
Jeff, do you want to speak to that? That's something that I've always been fascinated by. I know that's something that the learning and education team spend a lot of energy working on.
Yeah, sure. Of course, it's not our precise realm of expertise, and that's why one of the most important aspects of the Encyclopedia of Life is partnering with scientists and scientific organizations that actually do this work in the field and do the sort of the hard work of discovering the new species. But you mentioned the BioBlitzes. This is one way that we're trying to help bridge the gap between the general public and education opportunities for everyone and scientists. So this is one way that everybody sort of can help get involved and go out with scientists, learn more about what they do, and in some cases come up with new species. As you mentioned, in Biscayne National Park in Florida this year, several new species were discovered that hadn't previously been known to the area. I think there were six species of microalgae that were found. So it's that kind of discovery that can happen and involve the general public as well.
That must be so exciting to find something new, isn't it?
Yeah, and it's... I think a lot of people just don't even have a good idea of what's around them in terms of what is already known by scientists. So for kids and just the general public to get out and discover things that might already be known to scientists but are new to them and new to their school or community is really exciting.
And you have scientists. Tell me who all's involved in this. You have a number of scientists, researchers, museum people from all over the world doing this, don't you?
Yeah. So the Encyclopedia of Life is divided up into different component groups, and one of the component groups located at the Smithsonian is the Species Page Group, and what their sort of mandate is to make connections with scientists and organizations and individuals who have access to information either in the form of databases or other types of collections. So what they do is set up agreements with these different groups and essentially create a data exchange. And so you can think of the Encyclopedia of Life pages as an aggregation of content that comes from all over the place. So each page for one particular species might have 10, 20 different sources, and the page itself is an aggregation of all of that information.
Hmm. So by the year, is it 2016, you hope you have a list of everything, every species on Earth?
Well, I don't think, that's ever going to happen to the nth degree, because obviously, as soon as you think you're done, new species will be discovered. but yeah, I think, maybe 90% would be a great goal for 2016. And, if we got that far or even close to that, I think that would be an amazing accomplishment.
So, Jeff, when we talk about the rate of discovery and how much we hope to cover within the Encyclopedia of Life, we're also discovering that there are many species that are only known and defined by their original description. And this may be simply because they're extraordinarily rare or because no one else has gone looking for them. So as we work over the next 5 years, 10 years, 20 years to build the Encyclopedia of Life, we're shining some lights into the dark corners of our understanding of biodiversity and hopefully bringing attention to species that are understudied, whole branches of the tree of life that really have not been understood as well as they can. And one of the things we're hoping to add, Rhonda, is we're hoping to help create connections within the Encyclopedia of Life between species. Because it's one thing to have a card catalog of information about every living critter on Earth. It's entirely another to start creating information that describes how they're related to each other.
Yes.
And these connections over time, we think, are going to be as, if not more, valuable than the information about the species themselves.
So has there been a species that you thought, because I think this every now and then, when it comes to ticks and other things, why in the world is this species on Earth? I mean, what good does it serve? Have both of you had thoughts about certain species that you wonder, what good is this? And as a result of the project, you found out?
Wow, that's a great question. Jeff, I'm going to ask you to answer that if you could while I dig in my memory to come up with one.
I'm racking my mind to think of a specific example, but certainly in the case of, you know, things like mosquitoes, insects or whatever that we all sort of despise and want to get rid of, These are the kind of species where we really do need to help document how they interact with other species. What goes on in their life cycle that impacts other species, or how are other species impacted by them? In other words, like who eats the mosquito and who eats that species that eats the mosquito?
Yes, yeah.
And helping to put together a more thorough sort of documentation of that ecosystem level. Type of knowledge will really help both scientists and the general public understand why it's important to have what we call biodiversity, a huge range of species. And, you know, one of the other things to think about in terms of the Encyclopedia of Life is, as Bob said, it's important to go beyond just being a list of all possible sort of types of organisms. There are lots of databases and specialized projects that focus on a particular species or species groups, and scientists often rely on them and use them as the source of information or places to put information that they're studying. But the Encyclopedia of Life has a unique opportunity of bringing together this vast array of species in one place so that these interconnections or relationships between species can really be brought out. We talk about sort of a macroscope perspective on life. So this is one of the value added of the Encyclopedia Project.
And so is it through observation then that you find out what eats what and the importance of each link in the chain?
Well, certainly a lot of this information has been documented in some place. So when you read the description of some species, you might find that information, but there are huge gaps in the knowledge, and one of the things that we're trying to do in the Learning and Education Group is to help provide opportunities for scientists to communicate to the public about where they can help out, what kind of data they can collect, and it's a difficult challenge because, as you know, scientific observation and just the process of science is not always easy. So what we're trying to do is figure out ways that we can leverage the website and some of the tools we're developing to provide opportunities so that people can go out and help make these kind of observations. I saw this moth eating this particular plant, and start making those connections.
Mm-hmm. So, Bob, have you thought of an animal? You wondered why it was around?
Well, you gave me a few extra moments to go through. when I was... preparing for a speech last month at Ted Potomac in the D.C. area, I was trying to think of some relationships in my own backyard that I wasn't really mindful of, because when you're surrounded by strangers, you don't really pay attention to them. But when you start asking the names of the people around you, you start taking an interest in their lives and how they relate to you. It's the same way with plants and animals. And I was looking through my backyard and really noticed for the first time a particular plant and realized there were a lot more of it there this year than there were last year. And I took a picture of it and shared it with some friends and went looking in the Encyclopedia of Life. It turns out to be called garlic mustard. And I was wondering why it was there, and it turns out it's an invasive species in Illinois. It's not supposed to be there. And one of the things it does is it grows so aggressively and grows so tall that it swamps out the other plants growing underneath it and actually changes the nature of the insect population.
Oh, my goodness.
So as you start seeing a species that has never been in a place before and all of a sudden is introduced and starts proliferating because it either has no natural competition or the circumstances of that particular environment are really, really helpful for it, you become very sensitive to just how precariously balanced life on Earth can be. And we're very sensitive to that here in Chicago because of these Asian carp that are creeping their way up to the Great Lakes and all the great efforts that people are taking to prevent that from happening. So I asked myself why they're here. I wonder why they're here, and then I became very aware of the fact that it shouldn't be here. And what role can I take in protecting the natural biodiversity that's supposed to be here?
Right. Isn't that amazing? So it changed everything.
It really did. Not knowing what it was, not knowing its name, and not taking an interest meant that I could play no role. But now that I know its name, I can spot it wherever I see it now and can tell people the story of garlic mustard in a way that is helpful for them and then point them to resources that they can go to understand it as well. When you don't know the name of a person or a creature, it's easy to treat it with kind of indifferent contempt. But once you know the name, once you know its picture, you know it by sight, it becomes part of your story, and you can interact with it in a new way.
Right. I know that you've done invaluable work in the Gulf and that you are linking us to information about the huge number of species that are on the shorelines and the animals living in the Gulf. Tell me what concerns you have. I know you have concerns probably about all life in the Gulf right now, but what is the nature of that project?
Jeff, would you like to answer this?
Yeah, the Species Page group has really been the most active in putting together the sort of summary of information about what's going on in the Gulf. What we've done is provided a page, and it's listed on the, if you go to the main EOL site, which is just EOL.org, on our news section, there's a direct link to this page. But what we've done is linked to several of the projects that are involved, the organizations that are involved directly in the cleanup. So one thing I think we should point out is that the Encyclopedia of Life isn't directly involved in any of the cleanup or even conservation measures directly. What we're trying to do is really document what is out there, what's known, what's not known, and then provide that information to these organizations, which are really doing the hard work on the ground. So our webpage provides links to those organizations and then also lists some of the species that have been affected by the ongoing tragedy in the Gulf. And if you go to that page, one of the things you'll notice is that the turtles are probably one of the greatest species groups that's been affected and is in danger because so many of the turtle species are critically endangered from a population standpoint. Mm-hmm. So something like the hawksbill turtle, for instance, you know, they might lay 1,000 eggs, and one egg might survive out of 1,000 eggs. So, or one turtle might hatch out of that and survive, you know, the first year. So these populations are already threatened, and so the page tries to provide a summary or a snapshot of life in the area.
Jeff, if I could also suggest, one of the things that's become very important to many museums, in fact, I would think it's important to all of them, is finding ways that they can expose their collections, that is, when they digitize them and make them available to the world, they're literally turning their museums inside out. And I know at our museum, Museum of Natural History in Washington, D.C., our collection of specimens from the Gulf region is quite large. And in making that collection visible and then accessible to researchers, we feel it's going to be very important to the ongoing process of measuring the environmental impact of the spill and other environmental disasters that may come in the future. So the Encyclopedia of Life, over time, as a vehicle for helping promote museum collections and expose those collections to the world, and then, of course, make them available to be connected, I think has an important role to play in really turning those museums inside out so that their vast knowledge that they contain can help contribute to, you know, expanding the knowledge of species that are thriving or species that are threatened.
Right. And it must just increase your desire, although I don't know how you do this, to save all of those species. It is so hard to watch those animals covered with oil.
It really does. And I think, and Jeff, I know we've spoken about this in the past, is that when you capture knowledge and share it, it creates, I think, an awareness of what is hidden, and when you really show that this creature that you've taken an active interest in, that you read about it, you see its pictures, you understand its relationships, and then you change one thing in its environment and start seeing how that creature suffers. Maybe not individuals, but the whole species. It really is a call to action for us at the Encyclopedia of Life to do everything we can to look into all the corners of the world and find information and expose it and connect it and share it.
Mm-hmm. Well, and if I could just add
yes,
on to
please.
That, too. So one of the roles that we see for the learning and education group is to help provide some of the tools that will let people create and share information, because this is sort of one of the things that the encyclopedia can bring to the table. It can be used as a resource, as an encyclopedia, a place to get information, but it can also be used as a place to publish information. And so one of the tools we're developing this year is what you could call, I guess, a build-your-own field guide tool. So the idea there is that anyone will be able to define a geographic area and select the species they want to include, and then pull information from the Encyclopedia of Life and other sources, including their own writings if they want, and create these field guides for specific areas. And they could be a specific species group or just every species in the area. But the idea is to be able to create these and publish them and share them. And so we're trying to put these kind of tools in the hands of especially education groups, so that there's a mechanism for creation, I guess.
We welcome phone calls for our guests, and here's how you reach us, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, for you to join our conversation. We're talking about the Encyclopedia of Life Project. There, we were just looking at the special concern they have for what the species are, identifying those and watching them and seeing what happens to them and figuring out some ways to protect them, too, in the Gulf of Mexico. But this is a huge project that is organizing and making available on the web virtually all information about life present on Earth. There is a website there are 400,000 now. There will be approximately 1.8 million pages of the known species, and then there are some that they are finding that are not known yet, that provide entry points into this. So there's basic knowledge for those of us who can probably just take in the basic knowledge, and then more specialized information for scientists and people who work in museums, etc. Our guests are Bob Corrigan, Product Manager and Acting Deputy Director of Encyclopedia of Life. Jeff Holmes is Digital Learning Editor of Encyclopedia of Life. Here's our phone number, 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655, and we'll be with your calls in just a moment on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We talk about the Encyclopedia of Life this hour of the program. Lines are open for you if you'd like to join the conversation. We'd love to hear from you. Our number is 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. Can you tell us more? I was amazed how many people showed up in Florida for your latest event where people, I believe, all kinds of volunteers can come and just help gather species. Are these taking place all over the world, gentlemen?
Yeah, so the BioBlitz is really, in the sort of general sense of the word, I guess, an inventory of local species in a particular area. And so one of the types of BioBlitzes that's going on in the United States is a collaboration between the National Park Service, National Geographic, and the Encyclopedia of Life. And so this is a 10-year collaboration. So this year, as you mentioned, we had the BioBlitz in Biscayne National Park, which is just south of Miami. And it's really an opportunity to bring together bunch of scientists. In this case, we had, I believe, about 150 scientists with various types of interest, from insects to amphibians to fish. And then we had about 2,300 people that came from all walks of life. We had a number of school groups, which was quite exciting to organize, because one of the things about Biscayne is that 90-95% of the park is actually underwater.
Oh.
So you can imagine for arranging school outings.
Oh, my.
So the National Park Service is doing an amazing job organizing these events, and we're so happy to be part of it. What we're trying to do is provide both the encyclopedic information as a resource for especially schools to prepare and understand a little bit more about the species they might encounter, but then also provide these ways of giving students an opportunity to help build the encyclopedia. And one of the easiest ways, which anyone can actually contribute, is through our Flickr group. So Flickr is this online photo sharing website where you can sign up for free. And we have an Encyclopedia of Life Flickr group. And what you can do is upload images of species, and you tag them with the species name, and every night the servers sync up, and magically the next day the images will appear in the Encyclopedia of Life. Now, one of the sort of attributes of the encyclopedia is that it's trying to provide a source of authoritative information. So what we do for information that comes in from non-scientists or that hasn't been reviewed yet by scientists, we bring it in as unvetted information, and it will appear differently in the encyclopedia. It will have a yellow background, so people can differentiate between whether they're seeing authoritative or unreviewed information. And you can actually turn that on or off as well through site preferences. But this is a really nice way for middle school students through high school.
Oh, yes.
To really get excited and help feel that they're making a contribution to some big project and real science.
I am just amazed you had 2,300 people at this BioBlitz. That's a lot of people.
Yeah, I really don't know how they did it. I went to the a workshop for teachers leading up to the event. My two colleagues here in the learning education group actually went to the event, and it was quite amazing.
And how do you, Bob, decide where you're going to go? There are a lot of places on Earth where I'm sure you'd love to do BioBlitzes.
Well, the choice of where the BioBlitzes are held is really not up to the Encyclopedia of Life. There are other groups that arrange that. National Parks Service is certainly involved in deciding that. We're really going where the people are and looking to find ways to let the Encyclopedia of Life be a resource to those activities. I mean, there are even very small activities taking place at high schools, at community groups, and And while there may not be 2,300 people there, these are people who are engaged in understanding and defending the biodiversity of their small community. And where we know about these, we offer them resources to connect to the Encyclopedia of Life. We reach out to them to gather information that they've collected. And more importantly, we look to make a connection to them as an organization. Very often there'll be a group that is really interested in a particular what we call set of taxa. And they capture information, observations, they write descriptions, they maintain a database, and they're really passionate about it. And they'll find that over time they become a little island unto themselves of knowledge. And our part of our mission is to engage them as part of the global biodiversity community and bring their information in, expose them and their interests, and help them meet other groups who may have information that may be useful to them as well. Over time, hopefully, as the audience of people using and collaborating through the Encyclopedia of Life gets bigger and bigger, we'll have even more of these opportunities that we can help contribute to.
And is this happening in classrooms not only in the United States?
Yes, it's actually happening around the world. Great Britain is a country where BioBlitzes have become very popular, actually. And on our education site, it's education.eol.org, we actually have a BioBlitz series of pages about BioBlitzes, and we have a map where if anyone is organizing and setting up a BioBlitz, they can submit the name of the BioBlitz, where it's going to happen, and when it's going to happen, and it will show up on our map, and so that's just another outlet for this type of activity. But as Bob mentioned, it's something that can happen really, you know, with an individual, a group, a school, an organization. So what we're trying to do is help provide the tools and share best practices so mm-hmm. that if you were a group that was interested in doing something like this, we would be a resource to help you get set up and get started.
Why was it important? Did somebody have this grand idea to do this project? And if so, why? Or was it a group of museums all over the world saying this is something that we need to do? What were the origins?
The idea of an Encyclopedia of Life has been around for a number of years. And one of the biggest barriers to it has been technology. The availability of bandwidth to reach out to all the four corners of the globe, of advances in database technology, advances in applications that can get to this information. So we really had little islands of knowledge all over the world where experts were certainly aware of them, but the technology really wasn't sufficiently advanced to bring them together and synthesize them and integrate them to make it visible to everybody. Back around 2006, 2007, the idea started to get an awful lot of, as the technology evolved, a lot of energy started to be placed in it. And then a number of kind of happy accidents all happened at the same time. A number of institutions came together, including Harvard, Smithsonian, the Marine Biological Laboratory, the Field Museum, Missouri Botanic Garden, and started to create a proposal for doing this work, and we're collaborating with the Sloan MacArthur Foundations to prepare that. And at the same time, Dr. Ted Wilson won the TED Prize in 2007, and he had written about an Encyclopedia of Life prior to that. But for his TED Wish that he made at the end of that particular TED event, he wished that an Encyclopedia of Life would be created, and it just seemed to be a happy confluence of interest, technology, funding, and attention that all came together very quickly, and Encyclopedia of Life received its funding both from the Sloan and MacArthur Foundations and a number of smaller, very widely spread grants and donations, as well as the support of these five cornerstone institutions. And the product itself was launched in 2008, and we're entering our fourth year of operations as an organization. And while I think everyone would acknowledge that there's still a lot of work to do, the very fact that we've been able to operate, run, and sustain an Encyclopedia of Life and grow it over these last 3 years, I think is real honest proof that this can work and it will work, and it's worthy of being sustained.
Oh, it's great. You're looking at life that is there. Are you simultaneously looking at life that perhaps used to be there and isn't there anymore?
Wow, that is a fascinating question, and one that we deal with every day in working with our content partners. We also have in our the Encyclopedia of Life number of fossil species. Part of the sad reality of studying biodiversity is that every day species are vanishing, and sometimes they're vanishing and no one knows that they're gone. And part of the urgency of building the Encyclopedia of Life is to gather all the information, identify it, link to it, bring these islands of information into the fold, because it may be that that one database somewhere in South Africa holds information about a species that, unless we know about it and can understand the impact of some of our decisions on its ability to exist, not only might the species vanish, but the information about it may vanish because, you know, frankly, as scientists get older and as databases break down and machines break down, information becomes lost. And we're in as much of a race to understand the species around us and defend them and do what we can to show how they relate to others as we are to actually identify the information about these species. So over time, we expect to have as much as we can identify about creatures that exist and build our information historically through integrating museum collections and information they have about species we know to have already gone extinct.
So there might be many species or just a few that existed and are gone and we never even knew they were here?
Absolutely.
Oh, well, that's kind of a profound thought, isn't it? I'm not sure what to do with it.
Well, all we can do is be vigilant and pay attention and do our very best to find information, to integrate it with the Encyclopedia of Life to help the people who foster and maintain that information become part of a global community. And through that work, bring visibility and interest to the species that are special to them and that are unique to their area. And with just like my example earlier, if you don't know its name and you don't know it's there, it's easy to ignore it. But by giving every species a name, giving it a context, giving it a picture, telling a story about it, these things make life meaningful. They make it real. Without a name and a picture and information, it's a myth.
We welcome your phone calls. If you'd like to embark on a bio blitz yourself, if you're a teacher who wants to know where this information is available, if you have a species in mind and you wonder why it exists, as I have about certain species, feel free to give us a call. We'd love to hear from you in the time remaining. Here's our number, 800-486-8655, 800-486-8655. We have two guests with us. Bob Corrigan is product manager and acting deputy director of Encyclopedia of Life, which is an ever-expanding web-based biodiversity resource that was launched in 2008. The goal is enormous, to bring together information on all species known to science. Also joining us is Jeff Holmes, digital learning editor of Encyclopedia of Life. We'll go to your phone calls momentarily on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We go to your phone calls now. Anne in Madison, our first caller. Hi, Anne.
Hi. I heard on BBC last night, I haven't heard it on any American media yet, that there is a botanical research institute in Russia. Basically, it stores thousands and thousands and thousands of seeds. And it was established by a botanist, I guess, a Russian botanist in 1926. And the guy was arrested and deliberately starved to death under the Stalin regime. And his co-workers thought it was so important to preserve these original examples of seeds that they II to protect the Institute starved to death. And now the, I don't know whether it's a local government or whether it's the federal government, wants to destroy almost immediately this this 80-year-old, roughly 80-year-old research institute to make way for either a residential or commercial development. And I think this is the kind of thing, it's not getting much time, but this is the kind of thing biological researchers and botanists, people all over the world should be contacting their own government to put pressure on the Russian government about, and also contacting the Russian government. It's sort of, you know, it's not exactly what your guests are doing, but seems to me it's related.
Why would they take on something like this? What was the political problem with it?
Oh, well, I don't know. I have absolutely no idea. I assume some friends of important politicians, were putting pressure on them. I don't know whether, genetic engineering companies are concerned that all these original seeds are being saved and that they pose a financial threat to companies like Monsanto. I have absolutely no idea, but I assume either transfer of money or potential transfer of money is involved.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, Anne, for your call. Bob, Jeff, are you familiar with this?
I think what the call is referring to is the Vavilov Institute. And my understanding is it does date back to the late 19th century. There's another global seed vault, the Svalbard vault in Norway. Mm-hmm. And while I'm more familiar with the Svalbard global seed vault, I'm not surprised that there were large projects started in the late 19th century to create collections of plants and animals. There really was a golden age of discovery where people went out into all corners of the world and grabbed everything they could and brought it back. My understanding of the Vavilov Institute is they've got about 400,000 crop germplasms. Those were tissues with genetic information needed to that you could reproduce the original plant. The opportunity we have to preserve seeds and to sequence them and to make that information protected is something that I know a lot of people are very, very passionate about, and is a great source of information for Encyclopedia of Life to know about. So I'll definitely be doing some more research into the current state of that particular seed bank.
Good. We feel better because of that. Thank you. Sam in Iron River. Hi. Can you speak up a little, Sam? We can't hear you very well.
About the importance of the June bug. I work at a state park, and I spend a lot of time dealing with them in the end of their life cycles, and it seems to me like they don't have much importance, but I'm just wondering if there is any.
Okay. Did you hear that, gentleman?
No.
I know he was kind of quiet. He works in a state park, and he was wondering about the importance of the June bug, if you know about that or could find out, or could let him know how he could find out about them.
Okay. Well, one of the things you can do to find out what is known about a particular species, the Encyclopedia of Life stores not just the scientific names, but what are known as the common names as well. And we use some particular interesting search magic to be able to bring together all the known common names for a species. So if you search on any one of the number 100-plus names for cod, you'll come to a page on Atlantic cod. And in this case, I've gone to EOL.org, and I'm doing a search on June bug. And when I search on June bug, I come up with, you'll come up with a result for that. And I know that's one of the things I'll take away from our call today to find out what we know about June bugs and how we can make that visible through the Encyclopedia of Life.
Yeah, June bugs are kind of an interesting one, too, because they have so many different names, common names. I think, you know, some people call them May beetles, and I think it also depends on where they occur. So I don't know. I was just looking quickly, too, to see if there's any sort of magical property to them or or what. But it's a great example of a species that you can you could put into the Encyclopedia of Life and then research and go to some of the specialized links to find out more.
And would you get information, or is this something that other organizations might do or other scientists? We've heard that certain flowers are appearing, trees are appearing or budding at different times of year than they used to due to climate changes. Maybe different bugs, as you mentioned, when you were looking at that mustard, whatever that was called, the mustard.
Garlic mustard,
yeah. Thank you. And bringing along a whole new series of animals. Are you noting those changes as well in this species list here?
Well, this is one of the areas where EOL is very lucky to be partnering with other global biodiversity initiatives. And there's one particular called GBIF. And GBIF is in the business globally of tracking observations. And what we do is partner with this organization to gather information from them and then picture it on maps. So that associated with the species page, you'll be able to go and look at data from this global biodiversity information facility and see observations of either a species being sighted or other observations coming through other partners related to things such as first flowering. I know that's a particularly important marker that scientists look to understand climate change in a particular area. I want to go back and just reference for the previous caller, I was a little stymied working in the EOL searching on June bug, but then I searched on June beetle, and EOL lit up like a Christmas tree. So we've got the 10-line June beetle, the lesser June beetle, the northern June beetle,
wow.
The green June beetle are four separate species, all recognized by different partners, and the 10-lined, T-E-N-L-I-N-E-D, June beetle has an especially handsome picture associated with it. if you went to EOL.org and searched on June beetle,
okay,
you'll find a lovely picture there.
Nice things is that there's a classification tree available on each species page as well. And so you can browse that classification tree and find related species. So if you're looking at one particular species of June beetle, you can easily jump to related species. So it's a nice way to keep browsing and finding out more.
I used to know this at one point, and I can't remember anymore, so refresh my memory. What do we have the most of?
In terms of species?
Uh-huh.
Well, if you look at the, if you look at the 1.9 million identified and described species, about 1 million of them are insects.
1 million insects.
And those are just the ones we've identified and we've got names of them.
Yeah, and actually beetles happen to be one of the largest
groups. That's, what I,
group.
So, that's
yeah,
what I thought.
I believe they're somewhere on the order of 300,000 to 350,000 known species.
No, of beetles?
Yeah.
And you hardly ever see them. Or maybe you do. You should see them, but you're just not aware of them.
Well, sometimes, of course, you see a lot of one species, like the June bug.
That beautiful June bug, we might add. Let's go to Jeff from Superior. Hi, Jeff.
Hi, good morning. I think Noah would have appreciated this packing list had he had the opportunity before
yes.
he built his ark.
Right.
Well, I'm curious, in Lake Superior, are there any species that could still be down there? You know, it's a deep freshwater lake. Is there anything we don't know about Lake Superior?
Wow. My educated guess is that the answer is yes. It always is a question of scale. It's very easy sometimes to spot the big things, and often very challenging to spot the very, very small ones. So as we look to fully describe a particular ecosystem, scientists take many different approaches to identify all of the species that inhabit it, both at a particular area, but also at different times of year, with changes in temperature, with changes in currents, changes in the composition of the water chemistry because of pollution or other natural occurring events, the population of a particular area can shift gradually or dramatically over time.
My
hope is that as this information is discovered, that folks just don't write it down on a 3x5 card and tuck it into their closet. if it makes its way to the web, and if we do our job, ultimately connections to this data should appear in the Encyclopedia of Life and become available to everybody.
So you need to, tell me more about this. You need to check your area how often to be accurate about it? 4 times a year or to catch everything that might be there?
Jeff, what's your take on that? I've got my own thoughts, but I'm curious to hear yours.
Yeah, well, I think it's one of those almost unanswerable questions because it would certainly depend a lot on the type of environment. You know, at an oceanographic or a lake environment changes with the flow of the currents and the winds and certainly seasonal as well. And I think there are areas that we know a lot about and have been well-researched and people go back on a frequent basis. And then there are other areas, especially, you know, take the deep ocean, where we know very little. And almost every expedition that goes out and puts something out there and makes a collection, they find new species. So when we know so little about so much of the planet, it's amazing to think what we might learn if more people were paying attention and making more observations. I'm reminded of in Costa Rica, they have something like 25,000 species of insects. And of that, I think something like 10% are named. And I think of that, we know 1%. We know about the life cycle of 1% of that. So even just the...
Not much.
The basic information about species beyond just naming it is there are huge gaps in knowledge.
Mm-hmm. And let's talk about this deep ocean exploration. We've gone to the moon, for heaven's sake. We've got space vehicles looking at Jupiter and Venus and way the heck out there. Is there something exceptionally difficult about discovering the deep ocean?
Well, I think it's one problem, of course, is that it's vast and it's expensive. The pressures and the conditions working down there, as we know from the recent Gulf oil spill, make it an extremely difficult and challenging environment to work in. We do actually have another feature on our website that I wanted to mention. We're calling it the Podcast of Life, but these are stories about scientists who are working in different locations.
Oh.
We've been focusing on marine species. So one of the species that we covered recently is Riftia, which is one of those worms that many people, I think, have seen that grow in the ocean rifts around the lava or where the magma is coming up through the ocean floor. And so these weird and wild forms of life that that were previously, you know, very recently unknown, are being discovered. So there are these huge areas, but it's very expensive, and it's just a challenging environment.
One, just speaking of the deep ocean, there's a project that's just wrapping up a 10-year census, literally called the Census of Marine Life, and it's at www.coml.org. They're a content partner of the Encyclopedia of Life, and literally they're just getting ready to release their final report. And in the course of this 10-year project, 80 nations who were involved in this work, their goal was to assess and explain the diversity, distribution, and abundance of life in all the oceans. And you can go to coml.org and see wonderful pictures and learn how they went and did their work. And as they release their data over the coming years, it's a magnificent resource that we'll be looking to integrate with Encyclopedia of Life. And I know
that's great.
Are very much looking forward to receiving this information.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think what you're doing is so wonderful and exciting. Thank you both so much for being with us this hour.
Thank you very much.
Yeah, our great pleasure to have you here. Jeff Holmes, Digital Learning Editor for the Encyclopedia of Life, and Bob Corrigan is Project Product Manager and Acting Deputy Director of Encyclopedia of Life. Again, the website, and you can just learn so much, the June beetle and information about 400,000 other species. Just go to eol.org. And the other website about marine life, coml.org. Thanks to Rhonda Fanning for producing this fascinating show, and thanks to Rhonda as well for on-air production here in downtown Milwaukee. Until tomorrow.